Tennessee just sounds perfect.
Whether that's live music, the crack of a campfire, or kids laughing on an adventure.
To start planning your trip, visit tnvacation.com.
Tennessee sounds perfect.
This is the story of how a group of people brought music back to Afghanistan by creating their own version of American Idol. The joy they brought to the nation.
You're free completely. No one is there to destroy you.
The danger they endured.
They said, my head should be cut off.
I'm John Legend. Listen to Afghan Star on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Ridiculous History is a production of iHeartRadio. Welcome back to the show, Ridiculous Historians. Thank you, as always, so much for tuning in. Shout out to the man, the myth, the legend, super producer, Mr. Max Williams.
Hey, yo. What was the other one? It was
Oorah.
Oorah.
Oorah. Hoorah.
And huzzah.
And huzzah. And Atoski!
That's right. Huzzah is the one where if you're like a knight in something, you know, that's your rallying cry. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and you and I both will occasionally throw it in an email.
No doubt.
Yeah.
Part of the culture of how stuff works.
Yeah, I'm Ben Bullen. You're Noel Brown.
Tis I.
Big shout out to How Stuff Works, man. We've been doing this for a while. It's crazy that we haven't gotten to this story earlier. Mm-hmm. What's a good, for our folks in playing along at home, what's a good recap?
Yeah, first of all, listen to episode one that gives you a good, this is a really backstory rich tale here. So I think we did our due diligence there, teased a little bit about some of the incredible interactions between the U.S. Air Force and Hollywood, baby Hollywood, and some of the most brilliant set designers and builders and fabricators and, you know, just creative minds of the time to camouflage these crucial airplane manufacturing facilities to make them look like suburban towns in the hopes that the Japanese bombers would be confused and they would bomb other stuff. But then we ended the story of episode one kind of on the movie studios now being the only ones not camouflaged in this cluster of these kind of warehousey airplane hangar type facilities, to which the executives were like, hey, we need this too, because now we're going to be seen as the target.
Right.
Because we look a lot like airplane hangars. So I think that's where we enter.
That's perfect.
Yeah, with Boeing, because that really was what we teased this whole series to be about. I don't know that we've mentioned Boeing specifically quite yet.
No, we gave them a hard time about the planes and the fact
that's
that
right.
I almost died on one. But I don't think we mentioned that part, but moving on.
Apparently, it's fine. You're okay.
Our hero of the story here is the Boeing Wonderland. That's what part two of this series is really focusing on. So, like you said, everybody's trying to keep up with the Joneses. Now camouflage is something you must have because all these other places are camouflaged.
Mm-hmm. So, Lockheed's Cloverfield facility.
Mm-hmm, yeah. And so if we travel to Seattle, we'll see that Boeing's president, Philip Johnson, has been paying attention to his buddies at Douglas Aircraft, and he says, look, the biggest deal for us at Boeing is Plant 2. Despite the name, it is our number one.
Inspired.
Yeah. Our number one asset. Oh, right. So it's December 11th, 4 days after Pearl Harbor, Boeing puts out a press release, and they say the following. Plant 2 has been, quote, entirely transformed from a daylight plant to a blackout plant, enabling all-night operations during blackouts.
Okay. It goes on a little braggadociously. This plant is believed to be one of the first, if not the first, major defense plant in the country to complete this transformation. So, I don't know why I talk like a wizard there or something.
We both made some weird choices in our quotation voices, but this is true. What they're saying essentially is that now we can operate overnight.
Actually, I think a big thing to say about it is it now means that if you black out the city for if bombers are coming, they can still keep working in there.
Yes, good point. Max with facts. There it is.
Poetry. It's a big deal, you know, because they need to be, as we mentioned in episode one, the goal that FDR had set for the number of bombers that he wanted in their fleet, is that what you call it, in the sky, was insane. 50,000, I believe.
Right.
So they didn't have a moment to spare.
Mm-mm. And we also know that the Boeing News Bureau came out with a report about this and said... Well, they released on April 1st, 1942, but it was not an April Fool's Day joke. What they were describing to the public at large was the urgency created by the Pearl Harbor attack. And they said, look, we're not going to waste any time. We are getting everybody together that we can to help us do this blackout transformation.
We're going to have a painting party.
We'll have a painting party.
Yeah, yeah. And when we say blackout in this situation, we are referring literally to blacking out the building, right? Like painting it as dark a color as humanly possible. I don't think they had that, like, the blackest paint ever to exist at that point. But just, you know, regular old black paint would probably do the trick. And then that, you know, created a shroud around which they could build the thing that was, you know, meant to catch the eye.
Exactly. And again, these enemy bombers will be hunting with their own eyesight.
That's right.
So it makes sense to black everything out and reduce the amount of light the factory is emitting.
Funny, though, to think about it today with, like, advances in GPS technology and imaging, stuff like this wouldn't really work, would it? You'd be able to kind of see the shape or kind of know what you were looking at a little better if you had certain types of radar technology or, like, satellite, you know, imagery. But, I mean, even that, there are obviously ways that the military does their best to, you know, camouflage their stuff to those kinds of things. It would have been, it'd be a different type of job, though, right?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And so Boeing is already blacked out as a factory. You know, the windows are painted and et cetera. But they needed to do more. And so in May of 1942, the Corps of Engineers takes on this project. They say, we're going to camouflage this factory in addition to having it blacked out. And again, shout out to Bill Y, who wrote some fantastic research on this. So to accomplish this camouflage, our top talent in the world of military camouflage, the amateur magician, Omer, sends one of his boys from Hollywood, a guy named John Stewart Detley, art director. He sends this guy over to the Boeing plant.
He had pulled him from MGM, from the whole experiments they were doing back on the lots. I just want to add one little thing before we get into the actual full camouflage, the blackout situation with the paint, where they was an all hands on deck. Apparently, they required about 4 miles of air hose in order to allow for the operation of spray guns. So we don't have this exact, you know, square footage or the number of windows that they painted over. But if that's any indication, this is a huge job and a massive feat to accomplish in a couple of days. So now we're on to, you know, the business at hand, like to really make this building look like something else.
Yeah, absolutely. That's the idea, right? And so Detley is living this Hollywood dream. He's got a cool job that everybody wants. He has, you know, that degree in architecture. He is working as a set designer. He even gets nominated for an Oscar back in the day for his work on a film called Bittersweet, which I have not seen.
Nor have I. And a lot of the Oscar wins, you know, of this era of Hollywood are going to be a little bit deeper cuts than you might think.
Yeah.
You know, unless they're like the big classics that get remembered. Not all Oscar winners do stand the test of time. But I am interested to see this guy's work by checking out Bittersweet.
I feel like I won't pay attention to the story.
Yeah,
I'll just be watching the sets.
I know, we know too much.
Yeah, we've ruined it for ourselves.
and the stars of that I'm also not particularly familiar with, Jeanette McDonald and Nelson Eddy.
Nelson Eddy?
I don't know Nelson.
Okay, I don't either. I just thought if I said it with enough panache.
Yeah, you almost had me there. But in 1940, Dudley is only 32 years old, and he actually, like you said, living that Hollywood dream, marries an ingenue by the name of Constance Ackleman.
Love it.
It's a great old school Hollywood name. And they were quite a power couple in Hollywood, very sought after, both for their own set of skills, with Constance, you know, being a up-and-coming kind of starlet, and, of course, Dudley being a very sought-after art director.
Question for both of you guys. Mm-hmm. Do you think a 32-year-old man should marry an 18-year-old?
A little weird. I don't know. What's the formula? Isn't there a formula?
Not as bad as Charlie Chaplin.
Oh, we know that.
Oh,
sure.
No. That guy had a darkness to him.
I mean, 32, 18. I mean, yeah, this is a really cringe.
Is it a half
era.
Your age plus 7?
What's half the, your age plus 7 is
That, I feel, is weirdly misogynistic.
Oh, it is. I'm just saying it is a thing people say.
I was talking to a guy not that long ago, like a friend of mine. He's in his like mid-20s.
Okay.
And he's on Tinder. He's looking at like all these 19-year-old girls. I'm like, dude, like, he's like, well, I'm only like 6 years older than him. I'm like, yeah, man. We're like, I don't know. A teenager, that's like
a lot happens in that 6 years, though.
Yeah.
Anyway, you know, I hesitate to pass judgment. I was just curious on you guys' take. We do know that regardless of an age difference, they had a good union, right? Mm-hmm. They seem to get along famously, very much in love. Constance changes her name to Veronica Lake.
Oh, that's who I've heard of her.
She becomes a pinup girl.
Wow.
For World War II.
Quite a looker. That's right. She was sort of like the Shawshank Redemption, the poster of Betty Davis, I think.
This is
of that same kind of, you know, ilk, yeah. I guess, of, you know, massively sex symbol-y type starlets.
People are icons. Painting her on planes.
That's right. Yeah, that's right.
So her husband reports for duty in Seattle around this time. He gets pulled by Omer away from Hollywood. And when he gets to Seattle, everybody's very concerned about the Japanese occupation of those Alaskan islands we mentioned earlier.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, look, it's only a matter of time before we get attacked here in Seattle. We need you to get this plant, this Boeing plant, camouflaged quick, fast, and in a hurry. We need you to camouflage the entirety of 26 acres. This episode of Ridiculous History is brought to you by Mint Mobile.
You know, Ben, I got to say, one of the best parts about spring cleaning is that post-clean clarity you get where you're like, man, how have I been living like this? What's wrong with me?
You're right, Noel. It's kind of like when you find out you've been paying a fortune for wireless when Mint Mobile has phone plans for $15 a month when you purchase a 3-month plan.
It's time to switch to Mint Mobile and get unlimited talk, text, and data for $15 a month.
To get this new customer offer and your new 3-month unlimited wireless plan for just $15 a month, go to mintmobile.com/ridiculous.
That's mintmobile.com/ridiculous. Cut your wireless bill to $15 a month at mintmobile.com/ridiculous.
$45 upfront payment required, equivalent to $15 a month. New customers on first 3-month plan only.
Speed slower above 40 gigabytes on unlimited plan. Additional taxes, fees, and restrictions apply.
See Mint Mobile for details. This episode of Ridiculous History is brought to you by Snagajob.
Snagajob is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring.
With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snagajob is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs on demand, temp to hire, part-time, or full-time.
You name the position: warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer.
Yeah, Snagajob's got a worker for that.
With their easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way.
Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right?
Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly.
Visit snagajob.com or text snag to 242424 to talk to an expert.
Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
Tired of not being able to get a hold of anyone when you have questions about your credit card? With 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yes, you heard that right. You can talk to a human on the Discover customer service team anytime. So the next time you have a question about your credit card, call 1-800-DISCOVER to get the service you deserve. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Detlee's crews did this with the help of the Seattle District of the Army Corps of Engineers. And that was helpful because this particular structure was a different kind of roof situation than they'd been used to at some of the other airplane facilities, as well as, you know, the Hollywood studios. You could picture those, right? Flat roofed, kind of regularly shaped rectangles.
Right. Yeah, they have to deal with what's called a sawtooth roof. Think kind of like stepped down like a ziggurat. It's an uneven surface, varies as much as 35 feet. So wow. To build this, you got to put in other platforms. You have scaffolding. You also have to have a sprinkler system over the entirety of the 26 acres. Overall, this structure is going to weigh in with 555 tons of steel and 500,000 feet of wires, just support wires to make the houses look real.
That's a really good point, Ben. And I do just want to mention that, you know, as brilliant of an idea as camouflaging these places as, you know, suburban or like civilian areas are, it's not like war totally precludes the bombing of civilian areas. So yeah. There could well have been some collateral, you know, damage to these places, despite maybe they weren't targeting it, but maybe something fell nearby and there could have still been a fire,
right,
you know, in some of these elaborate roofing situations. So that's why they had to have that sprinkler system.
Mm-hmm. And so travel with us to what was increasingly being called Wonderland because of the variation in the height of those structures that they were building on top of. There were a lot of very steep hills in the area. It's kind of like San Francisco. So there were three major streets, major fake streets. There were alleys, there were driveways. This was immersive. They even named the streets. Why did they name them? I guess it's just for morale. A bomber pilot's not going to be able to read this stuff, but they had names like Synthetic Street and Burlap Boulevard.
Wow. That's like a little bit of a nod, yeah, to the craft, right, of building these things. You know, it reminds me a lot of some, again, early kind of practical effects in movies, like the idea of a matte painting, which is like, you know, not incredibly detailed, but it has a massive scope to it. So it'll be like the background of like a massive space scene. Then they superimpose the ships in front of it, or it could be like a cityscape. But if you ever see one of those in person and you look up close, there will be little signs that have like text on them. But if you look up close, they're just kind of blurs, you know, like just sort of like, so this is all about creating the illusion from afar, right?
Yes, very much is. And they make a bunch of artificial trees too. It reminds me of, you know what it is? It's a life-size version of those little towns you build around toy trains.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah.
It reminds me of that scene in Beetlejuice where they shrink down.
It's really cool.
Yeah. Oh, Beetlejuice, man.
Oh, it's good. I hope the sequel's good because Tim Burton really hasn't had a banger in some time. So,
you know, the first sequel idea was Beetlejuice at the Beach.
Interesting.
It's definitely a choice.
Yeah. He does have the straight, you know, when I think of his outfit, it does kind of remind me of the stripy short pants that like you'd see beachgoers wearing like in the 20s or whatever.
Oh, yeah.
But in any case, there's a lot of set building kind of, you know, methods and tech that come into play to create the illusion from afar that we're talking about. Something called tar and feathering, I guess, which is something that was used to make the texture of like trees, for example, you know, where again, from afar, you would never be able to tell the difference because it has that look and quality. But up close, you would definitely be able to tell what it is. It's the same with stage stuff. You know, if you ever examine stage sets up close, there's a lot of rough edges. There's a lot of things that wouldn't really read if you were up close, but from the audience, it looks great.
Yeah.
And in this case, the audience is 5,000 feet up in the air.
Right. They're thousands of feet away. They're playing big, right? Just like stage acting. And a lot of these things, these homes, these garages, these greenhouses, even the gas station, a lot of them are only about 4 foot high at the eaves. And so like you said, up close, it doesn't make sense. If you go inside, you're going to see that they just have that sprinkler system.
Yeah, exactly. Buildings all over again, you know, except this infrastructure is literally designed to protect the fake building.
Exactly. And so at least two of these homes were going to be occupied by real people.
What?
Sort of. Because
kind of stand-ins, I guess. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, they had guys who ran anti-aircraft guns. And they were stationed in little fake houses on the rooftop.
Armed stand-ins.
Yes. Yeah.
They armed were just kicking it. Yeah. No, that's cool. So they had to have all these elaborate catwalk systems that would allow people to kind of move between the different spaces for various reasons, for maintenance, et cetera. Man, that is so cool. The people occupying it. That does make sense. You would need some anti-aircraft support, you know, in the event that your little subterfuge didn't quite work.
Yeah. Absolutely.
You don't want to just leave it all up to them being fooled, you know? You got to have some backup personnel in place.
And that feels like a cool job.
It does, doesn't it?
I got to wake up and go to my fake house.
Yeah, exactly.
And I might have to shoot something out of this
super
guy.
Secret spy stuff.
Right. And they also realized you can't just make a town. It has to have accoutrement, all the trappings of life.
Can't look abandoned, you know. There have to be cars on the road, parked, you know, accurate looking that would read. So they built some of these cars, parked them, made out of rubber. And because they had to kind of, again, with the rough edge approach and the boxiness of making these fake cars out of wood and rubber, they started looking more, again, Bill points this out, Bill Y, Yen, yeah, Y, interchangeably there, points out that they really kind of looked a little more like the cars of the 70s.
Yeah.
Those kind of boxy station wagon-y type cars. Or like a Gremlin, I think, maybe.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then there was even this legend or tall tale that said they let a cow loose to roam around on the rooftop, which is clever because that does look like, I guess, like an active town. But also, when's the last time you were on a city street and you just saw a random cow?
Well, yeah, because I'm picturing the scale of this, and it isn't smaller scale. It's got these are like built to scale. So everything would be roughly the size of the real thing. So like a cow roaming around, it would be able to roam around the streets, but it would be a little odd. Why'd they do that, Ben? Why'd they do that?
That never happened. They actually didn't.
Okay.
Which
it was discussed. Makes sense.
Yeah, people just, I think it's one of those stories that just kind of spread.
I see.
Also, I think that's too realistic. And I want to point this out because we're an audio podcast. There was a moment where I asked you about seeing a cow on the street and you paused. And for a second, I thought you were going to be like December 13th, 2014, Augusta, Georgia.
Yeah, that'd be cool. Not a cow. I've seen random horses.
Yeah.
Oh, and crap, dude. I meant to mention this. I was just in Boston for funsies and my buddy Frank. Friend of the show went to a movie theater near Harvard and we're running around Harvard campus, and guess what we were nearly accosted by?
Turkeys.
Yes.
Yeah. Told, man, they suck.
I did not realize that, and you know I have a fear of birds, but I believe in the past, on one show or the other, we've talked about, like, turkey attacks in the Boston area because there are these wild turkeys that just roam free. If this part of the country had a reputation for free-roaming cows, that might have been a smart move. But outside of that, probably would have given away the game a little bit.
As a friend to all animals, even unto the naked mole rat folks, I assure you, turkeys are terrible.
They're scary,
if
dude.
If turkeys were people, they would be criminals.
I agree.
And they gang up on you.
They
can't
do.
Show weakness.
I Googled it when I got back to the Airbnb, and I found a story from very recently about a Cambridge U.S. postal worker who was attacked by a gang of turkeys with such ferocity that he fell over and broke his hip and had to have a hip replacement.
Mm. They'll also just fall out of trees.
At you.
And they get mad at whomever is around.
At you, dude. Yeah. You know that would be my waking nightmare.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. you feel the way you feel about turkeys is the way the U.S. feels about Japanese invasions.
That's fair.
You're like, that is at fair. Any moment, the other shoe's going
to
drop.
Bro, if I was standing on that beach waiting for that shoe to drop, looking for something coming at me on the horizon, my, like, the traveler moment in Ghostbusters where I'm picturing, you know, whatever the thing is that comes for me, it would be turkeys.
Yeah.
But yeah, my goal would be not to picture anything. But what would come into my head that would terrify me would be a giant turkeys coming
at me. They're just absolute pieces of trash. So, wow, that's a hot take I didn't see coming today. They actually did a lot more work than just what we've described, which is already a big deal. The folks who built and maintained this project at Plant 2, they also stayed active doing other stuff during the war. And there is a monograph, like a piece of short writing by Leroy Robert Hansen.
I like Leroy, but...
I like Leroy, but it is Leroy.
The way it's spelled, though, is L lowercase e capital Roy. So I don't know, it might be Leroy.
Leroy sounds more intriguing than Leroy.
Leroy Robert Hansen, he was the chief of the agronomy section and also involved in the Boeing project. And I believe you mentioned the monograph, right? 1943?
Yeah, it's got a super sexy title. Everybody settle in and get comfortable. The use of grasses and legumes for camouflage and dust control on airfields with a Seattle dateline.
What?
I know, right? Just the tension.
But the funny thing about that, too, is the idea of grasses and legumes and using different material, that's another thing that you can kind of see in the fabrication of, like, Disney World, you know, and, like, the fake mosses and things to achieve texture, like in the Avatar ride queue. All this stuff goes hand in hand. That's so fascinating to me, the intersection between entertainment and warfare, you know?
Absolutely. And we know that they had to surmount a couple of different challenges. One of the big things was camouflage paint. They had to get a texture that paint would adhere to, but that would also not interfere with air traffic. And so eventually, going to the point of things looking kind of rough up close, they said, we're going to use a crushed rock surface and we're going to roll it with an adhesive material for paved areas. We'll use wood chips with cement for non-traffic areas. And then for the parts of the complex that are between or past the runways, the houses get increasingly less realistic.
Right.
They turn into like these concrete slabs.
Yeah. Yeah,
just,
but again.
Just because you can't have a plane hit it.
And again, you know, keeping with our whole, like, this is meant for an audience of 5,000 feet, the things that would be farther away from, you know, what would be perceived would be less important. Sort of like some of the, you know, details on those matte paintings I was talking
exactly,
about.
Exactly, yeah, yeah. And, you know, speaking of matte painting, I've got to just shout this out. I rewatched a film that captivated me for a long time from Dusk Till Dawn.
Sure.
Not the Japanese crime bar
vampire
that
one.
I hang out with. That I hang out at. Yeah, Dusk Till Dawn has this great matte painting at the very end. Do you remember this moment where they, spoilers, by the way, 3, 2, 1, spoilers. It's dawn. They're leaving the bar.
Presumably the film begins at dusk.
Yeah, well, you remember the film.
No, I'm just saying the movie is dusk. It's dawn.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a nice arc.
The bar is named Titty Twister. And so as they're pulling away, and this is so cool, the camera pans out and it's that big matte painting and you see the bar is just the top of an ancient Mesoamerican temple.
Oh, that's right.
That's so cool.
That is cool. Okay, now you got me wanting to watch that again. Sequels, I think, probably paying less dividends. But
I have not watched it.
I've only seen clips, but they don't look very good. But the first one is schlocky by design and a hell of a lot of fun.
Mm-hmm. Agreed. And and we're bringing that up because if you see matte paintings, like you're saying, in film, then you'll notice, if you look closely, that the detail does decrease the further into the quote-unquote background you get. And that's kind of what they're doing here with Boeing Wonderland.
But to the title of that, the absolutely captivating title of that monograph we talked about, they would decorate these quote-unquote lawn areas and vacant lots with actual grasses and weeds designed by the members of Leroy Hansen's agronomy team.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're falling into it. We're calling them Leroy.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, we have to.
It's just so classic. It's like the Roy.
Oh, yeah. It's like, or it's like, you know, the Rob Roy. So Detley and his team are really knocking it out of the park with this camouflage. This Bill Y describes it as passive defense, which I think that's smart because it is not, you know, I mean, there are the gunners there in case of an emergency, but this is pure subterfuge, you know, and it seems like they're putting so much thought into it. How could it fail? There were other initiatives in place planning active defense, such as the execution of fire and air raid drills and the installation of some air raid shelters. And that was handled by a guy by the name of Glenn V. Dierst, among other commanders that were in charge of these other kind of aspects of the whole deal. Another news release from the Boeing News Bureau that came out in 1943 said that all of the plant personnel would be able to reach those sheltering spots, those bunkers, in less than 12 minutes. So, you know, the safety of the employees, it would appear, was also pretty paramount. Yeah, let's not have any illusions. It was all for humanitarian reasons. They needed the workers to get the job done. You know?
Well, because they also wanted to build war machines.
Yeah, that's right.
50,000 something. And it's strange because Seattle was, as we established, a unique problem for a couple of different reasons. If you have ever looked at the ground from an airplane, you notice that it's very easy to identify things through seeing the shape of the shore, like where land and water meet. So New York and San Francisco are very easy to recognize because of their shorelines. Des Moines or Topeka is different because their appearance is defined by rivers and bays. And Seattle is between Lake Washington and the Puget Sound. So it's very easy to find landmarks if you know what you're looking for. And for this reason, our buddy Detley says, we're going to have to do some more stuff with this Boeing project. We're going to camouflage the employee parking lots. They're just too big and too obvious. We're also going to cover sections of other adjacent land. And we might need to make a fake river.
Yeah, because to your point, you know, this is a feature that would be necessary to sell the illusion, you know? I mean, not necessarily the Japanese bombardiers were, you know, intimately familiar with the geography of the United States, but, you know, to make it ring true, you know, to make it read as a successful illusion, you know, the way that stuff's laid out is really, really important.
Yeah, agreed, right? And again, lives are on the line here. The future of the world actually depends on this camouflage plan, even if it sounds silly. So he has this plan. He's going to reroute the Duwamish River. They never actually do this because here's the pickle. And Max, we were all talking about this off air too, man. Here's the pickle. There were not any further camouflage projects after 1943 because by the time they built this stuff out, the course of the war had shifted.
Yeah.
This episode of Ridiculous History is brought to you by Snagajob.
Snagajob is where America goes to hire with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring.
With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snagajob is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs on demand, temp to hire, part-time, or full-time.
You name the position: warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer.
Yeah, Snagajob's got a worker for that.
With their easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way.
Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right?
Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly.
Visit snagajob.com or text snag to 242424 to talk to an expert.
Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
Tired of not being able to get a hold of anyone when you have questions about your credit card? With 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yes, you heard that right. You can talk to a human on the Discover customer service team anytime. So the next time you have a question about your credit card, call 1-800-DISCOVER to get the service you deserve. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
When you drive a vehicle so reliable it's backed by a 10-year, 100,000-mile limited warranty, you stop thinking about what you can't do and start doing what you never thought possible. Visit your local Kia dealer today to see what you're capable of in a vehicle that inspires confidence around every corner. Kia, movement that inspires.
Call 800-333-4KIA for details. Always drive safely. Limited inventory available. Warranties include 10-year, 100,000-mile powertrain and 5-year, 60,000-mile basic. Warranties are limited. See retailer for details.
It's kind of like when you are, it's like, imagine, we both love cooking projects. Imagine cooking something really involved that takes hours, and right as you're, right as you're about to pull those beautiful slow-cooked ribs out of the oven, your partner or your friends show up and they brought takeout.
Yeah. KFC.
Right.
And you're like, well, KFC in Japan.
I tried. Right.
Well, that's the thing, though, too, where we almost don't have any way of knowing exactly how effective this stuff was.
Yeah, good point.
Because it, yeah, because of exactly what you said. And when we say the war shifted, does that mean it became more of a ground offensive, or it just the, what happened? No, obviously not. And I wouldn't say that. What was it about the tactics that changed?
Well, by that point, Japanese forces had been driven from those Aleutian Islands, and they were increasingly on their heels. So they were much less likely to take an offensive posture.
Got it.
Or to be able to do so, right?
Ben, check my dates. Guadalcanal was like 43, correct?
I believe that's correct, yeah.
That's like the first really big offensive, because by this point in the war, the Japanese weren't really bringing the fight to the United States. The United States were bringing the fight to them. Because
right, the island hopping and stuff. So the fear, the overwhelming paranoia of 1942 starts to fade. People are feeling a little, now they're just
safer-ish,
a little nervous. Mm-hmm. But then eventually that fades too, and they say, okay, that was a crazy couple of years, huh? And they go to the Japanese-American population of the U.S. and they say, sorry, we locked you up. And they're like, it's not cool. And they're like, are bad.
Well, it's like, you know, I recently watched the Aviator for the first time, and you know, during the height of these wars, when production was so important and innovation was so important, you kind of spent the money and asked the questions later, despite what we said about having to convince, you know, the brass that these camouflage ideas were good. You know, a lot of times this happened. They'd make tons of planes, or they'd do a project, and then things would end or change, and you would basically have spent all this money for nothing. But that's just part of the nature of, you know, being prepared, like the Boy Scout code of ethics, right?
Yeah, it's like Henry Kissinger would later go on to say, just get it done, and then we'll make it right later.
That's exactly right.
You know, also, he is sort of like if a turkey was a person. So...
How do you really feel about Henry K?
A dead person.
Yes.
We can finally say that.
That's true. We got a lot of text messages about that one, you know. I was a little freaked out. I was like, I don't know if I want you congratulating me on my phone, guys. So now that we walked down the street to take a unprompted shot at a dead man, we do have to tell you these rooftop camouflage fake town things, like you said, Noel, there was secrecy involved, but it's tough to keep that stuff secret. Like if you lived in the town, you would know something weird was up. It looks like somebody's built a mini golf course or a putt-putt course on top of the airplane plant.
Well, and to our earlier point, you know, this stuff at the time would have been completely off limits to any civilians, highly guarded, you know, classified, wouldn't have been any chatter about it on the, you know, the radios or what have you, and any communication that wasn't encrypted. But now we're left with these sort of weird kind of tourist attractions that are built on top of these, you know, these airplane manufacturing facilities that are making these weapons of war. And like you said, people that lived near there, they know what's going on. You see the stuff being built, you know. So what do? They kind of spin it as like an act of goodwill to the public or sort of, right?
Yeah. Hey guys, we were thinking of you.
Psych! This is for your kids.
Exactly. On July 17th, about a month before, around a month before the Japanese government officially announces unconditional surrender, the Army Corps of Engineers says, look, we've already sent out some contracts to private entities. They're going to dismantle these fake towns. We're not going to keep these around too long. They are no longer relevant. So, for instance, like a company out of L.A. called LB Cotton Company, they got paid a little less than $250,000 to take apart the Boeing Wonderland within 150 days. So all told, we're looking at a cost of $2 million. Right? $2 to $3 million.
Did we mention that like setting foot on these fake roof, you know, top attractions prior to this would have been a serious crime?
Oh, we didn't.
Yeah.
We should.
Yeah. I mean, you know, again, because of the levels of classification and the secrecy around it and, you know, the fact that you could accidentally get yourself probably blown up by a, you know, a gunner. Yeah, this would have been a big deal. And then within the course of a couple of months, the tide turned and now it's like this almost tourist attraction. And it goes from that to being very little memory of it, you know, having ever having existed.
Right.
Were you able to find any photos from this brief period of photo op time?
We have just a few. If you go to, and we mentioned this in part one, if you go to rarehistoricalphotos.com.
That's right. I remember that old chestnut.
Yeah. I mean, we went deep on this one. But if you go to Rare Historical Photos, and shout out to Max for finding this, you'll see a couple of different still photographs where you can kind of see the edge of a roof with the fake trees and the planes beneath. And then you can see one guy walking around this uncanny valley town.
Trees look weird. The trees look
weird.
Like they're made of polygons or something, like a bad 90s sim game.
This is
you
like
know?
A Sega Saturn version of a town.
But again, from a distance, these would have looked like trees, you know? I mean, they knew what they were doing, man. This is super interesting stuff. The grass looks like grass. The snozzberries taste like snozzberries, you know?
And then you really, folks, to get a sense of this, both the size of it and the weird scale of the buildings, check out this article. You can see a couple standing next to the plywood paneled house.
You can see a little scale kind of.
See how short the houses are. You can see those hills we talk about because of the uneven sawtooth roof.
Okay, so I had said something earlier about how everything was kind of to scale, and I think maybe we buried the lead on this. I'm sure we mentioned it, but yeah, they're like squat looking, you know? Because again, from a height, you wouldn't be able to tell. As long as they were wide enough, you wouldn't really be able to tell how tall the houses were, because all you're seeing is the flat parts or the parts that are, you know, peaked. So it's brilliant. As long as the scale of the width and the length were right, the height didn't really matter. So they're these funny little kind of dwarf houses.
Exactly. Like Chick-fil-A. Oh, man, that was such a cool thing.
So here's a photo that I saw that I did not even think about this until right now, but I was scrolling through the photos, and it's the people walking outside of a building going to another building, and above them is still the town, because of course you have to have the town going over all of it. I'm like, I didn't think, it's like, it's not just like one big building, it's a giant campus.
I mean,
one thing I was in Seattle late last year, and my buddy and I, we kind of did like a loop. We went across Mercer Island, stuff like that, and came down, and we came up, like, you know, through like the south side of like Lake Washington, and that's where a lot of the, you know, aviation stuff in Seattle was built and where it is still today. And I was going through, I'm like, man, this is like, we didn't have enough time. It was very like short trip there, but I'm like, man, next time we're here, I want to go check out all the Boeing stuff here.
Yeah. Sure.
Yeah. And this is also, this is where we see a really strange and neat thing. So it's an open secret. People aren't allowed around these mystery towns, but now that they are irrelevant and people have worked so hard on it, we get the sense that a lot of people said, well, we should at least let people know we did something.
That's right.
Guys, we worked so hard on our art project.
And who knows? There might be another world war coming down the line where we need to do this again. We need to sort of patent our idea at the very least in the court of public opinion.
So Boeing and Douglas Aircraft are like, okay, we're going to at least do some photos, guys. We built out these elaborate sets. So they got a bunch of female employees and said, get to the rooftop, stroll around.
Yeah, just, that's what we're looking at, right?
Yeah, so, just act like you're in a regular American suburb. And then these pictures get published in Boeing News and Douglas Air View and Boeing Magazine, and they get published.
Look what we did.
Right as this stuff is being torn down, and within a few months, it's back to a regular rooftop. Also, by the way, John Stewart Detley, the creator of Boeing Wonderland. He is
Hollywood bigwig, art director, husband to the stars.
He's starting to have a tough time.
Right. Yeah. The star in question, Veronica Lake, sex symbol, icon, movie star. Their relationship began to disintegrate, and it actually ended 3 months after she had an unfortunately terminated pregnancy. She actually, I believe, took a tumble and, you know, while filming, and that led to a miscarriage. And Detley, you know, he kind of had peaked, it would seem. He was never able to kind of reestablish himself in the film industry and didn't go back to California for 20 years. And then he married another woman named Virginia Crowell. And, you know, let's not forget, he did have a background in architecture after all.
Right.
So he did become a pretty well-regarded architect in Seattle.
Mm-hmm. And eventually, unfortunately, he loses a second young child. Their three-year-old passes away. They leave Seattle after that point. They spend time in Hawaii and Baltimore before settling in Southern California. While this is happening, the blackout paint is being stripped from the factories all up and down the coast. And even John Francis Omer, the magician and camouflage enthusiast, has retired.
End of an era.
End of an era, indeed. And you can find people who still study this, like Bill Yen or Yenne. You can also find folks like Mike Lombardi, who has an amazing job. I can't remember who I was. Oh, I was talking with my one of my sketch comedy buddies, Simon, about this. A lot of big companies have a corporate historian, and your job is just to be the nerd who knows about stuff. I would love that job.
Depends on the company, though, right?
Yeah, like a candy factory, a Wonka thing. That'd be nice.
Unless the background involves, you know, the appropriation and abuse of indigenous people. Yeah.
Did you read the original book, the Roald Dahl book?
It's a little problematic the way they're addressed.
It is intensely problematic. Yeah,
because they're like basically like pygmy, right. African, you know, indigenous people.
Also, if you want to learn more about Roald Dahl's dark side, I highly recommend this book, George's Marvelous Medicine.
I have read that one. It's a shorter one. It's a quick read, but it's pretty dark.
Yeah.
He has a handful of those sort of more young adult kind of ones.
It's a book where, just so you know, folks, if you want to be like the cool parent or the cool like uncle or aunt or something, when the kid's old enough, introduce them to stuff like Edward Gorey and George's Marvelous Medicine. This kid, his parents leave to go shopping or something, and he decides that he's going to kill his grandmother.
Okay.
That's how it starts.
You need to say no more. Also, I remember one that probably did not age well is called The Twits.
Oh, gosh. I forgot about that.
That's a pretty rough one in terms of let's just say, lampooning of what today would be considered mental health concerns.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. But
we also have an episode about Roald Dahl and his time as a fighter pilot himself, and how it's entirely possible that his good friend Ian Fleming based a lot of the aspects of the James Bond character on Roald Dahl.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and our corporate historian for Boeing, Mike Lombardi, he remains amazed in interviews. He's saying, look, we've got almost a century's worth of making great airplanes. You would think that most people asking us about the history of Boeing would ask about things like the B-17 or the 747. But nope, the most popular subject is the neighborhood on top of Plant 2. Everybody still is captivated by this, as are we. And I think we've gone a lot of directions in this series, and we appreciate you, as always, folks, for tuning in. We love weird, obscure World War II history, as you can tell from our past episodes. Shout out to our super producer, research associate for this, Max Williams, throwing some semaphore out there.
Hua?
Helping us land the plane.
How? Hoorah and huzzah.
And Atoski.
Mm-hmm. Yes, indeed. And thanks to Nathan Atoski for keeping our marketing ducks in a row.
Yes.
Our podcasts.
Yes. And thanks to Jonathan Strickland, a.k.a. The Quister. Thanks to AJ Jacobs, a.k.a. The Puzzler. And thanks to, let's see, who else? Oh, well, Alex Williams.
Alex Williams composed our theme. Chris Frastiotis and his wizard beard, Eve's Jeff Coates, both of them here in spirit. And thanks to you, Ben, for allowing us to be each other's wingmen.
And also,
can I be the Iceman?
I thought you wanted to be the Bagman.
Well, I just meant in our Top Gun kind of scenario.
Oh, okay. I've never seen Goose. Top Gun.
I don't know either. I just know there's a character named the Iceman.
As long as I can be your Huckleberry.
You're always my Huckleberry.
That is such a cool line.
Pie, not thin.
Mm-hmm. I think we got it.
I think we do. We'll see you next time, folks. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
This is the story of how a group of people brought music back to Afghanistan by creating their own version of American Idol. The joy they brought to the nation.
You're free completely. No one is there to destroy you.
The danger they endured.
They said my head should be cut off.
I'm John Legend. Listen to Afghan Star on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets and help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters every afternoon. I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen.
And I'm David Gura. Listen to The Big Take on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.